This week, on the end of the parsha, and Moshe is very suspicious, and he's very irate. What can I say? He's suffering, so we would say PTSD, because he remembers what happened to the Meraglim, and this sounds a lot like the Meraglim. It may sound a little bit like Korach. I'll see you later why. Doesn't sound like Korach. So what do the what happens in the aftermath after all this concern is raised, and how do they quiet these concerns? Let's first talk a little bit about the concern. Very famous turnaround. Like Shur Lava Yamru, they come and they say, Gideros Tzon Nivne L'Makneinu Po V'Yarim L'Tapeinu. So they're prioritizing their money, prioritizing their cattle. First we want to talk about our pastures and our cattle and our commerce, and then about our children. And then they promise, after they will deal with their cattle and deal with their financial profit and deal with their children, then we'll accompany the rest of the Jewish people across the Yarden. So Moshe's response is, of course, very famous. He says, "If you follow my expectations, build places for your children, and then cattles and corrals for your cattle and for your oxen." So part of Moshe's turnaround is not just demanding their obligation, demanding their commitment, but helping them reprioritize what's more important, money or children. That's a very famous, Rashi has pointed out, this is Pasuk Lamed Beis, Chasim hayu al mimonam yosam ibneihem, uvenoseihem, shekdim miknanam litapam. They're more concerned with their profit and their cattle than with their children. Amalhem Moshe lo kenasu hikar v'tafel tafel, so Moshe corrects them. So, very, very famous, obviously, message. You know, one day you'll all be professionals. Children, relationships are far more important than achievements and how many zeros you have at the end of your salary. That's the obvious takeaway from Rashi. But I think there are two sub-takeaways from Rashi. Number one is that the real drama here is courage, bravery, ideology. That's the real drama. If you ask people, what's the real drama of B'nai Gad or B'nai Reuven? It's not whether they're greedy and they care more about money than they do about their children. The real drama is, are they ideologically engaged in the state of Israel? Are they ideologically committed to fighting alongside of their brothers? It's a question of ideology and idealism, not of avarice and greed. But what you see is, and this is Moshe's fear, and this is part of Moshe's correcting them, is that people who are greedy are less likely to be ideological. And that's what concerns him. He says, look, I know that I could create a contract with you, but first I need to know, forget Israel, forget the other Shvatim, forget the Torah, just at a moral level. Are you people who have your values in order? And are you people that are modest and you value relationships and you're honest and you have integrity? Because once you enter the land of greed and you enter the land of trying to make a quick profit and that becomes your driving force, then ideology is hard to come by. That's part of what we're living through today. Where people, Baruch Hashem, capitalism, and now we're suffering a bit of a difficult time, inflation and a bear market, but in general, capitalism has unleashed earning potential, and Baruch Hashem, we're more comfortable than we've ever been in the past, but there's a culture of profiteering and a culture of commerce and a culture of making money, and that's slowly eating away, not just at challenges and averos and dangers within the financial world, but what does it mean to be ideological? What does it mean to live a life of idealism? What does it mean? So there are two dramas taking place here. One is the drama that's obvious, commitment to Israel, commitment to the future of the Jewish people, commitment to your brothers, commitment to war. And then Moshe says, by the way, we can't assure that idealism will be solid until I make sure that you're not acting upon greed, but you're acting upon values and relationships and honesty and simplicity. That's part of what you see in Rashi. The other thing that you see in Rashi is that sometimes interactions with people are complex, and you have to operate at different levels. Moshe is irate. Moshe's real concern is this shouldn't be the Meraglim. That's his primary thrust. And he could get so swept up and so caught up in that he ignores the moral issue. And he just says, look, I just promise me you're not the Meraglim. Promise me you're going to fight for Israel. Promise me you'll support your fellow Shvatim, and I'll be all right. And Moshe has enough sensitivity and versatility. You know, there really are two dramas taking place here. One is the drama that I'm really invested in, and that's Israel and courage and Jewish history. But by the way, I have to tell you, there's another issue taking place here. Even if they're not as related as I made them seem in the beginning, there was mispriorities. And you misprioritize children and family life and friendships and community, and you prioritize money and commerce and profit over them. Sometimes in life, we get swept up by the big show, by the big issue, and we ignore smaller issues. And it's very important when people ask you for advice, when you're thinking about yourself. Very often, the hardest issues in life are multi-layered. That's what makes them so difficult. When we deal with one variable, we hone in on that variable, and we try to deal with them. But very often, especially as life gets a little bit more complex, you've got a lot of different variables. A lot of things are ganging up against you. It's when people feel real panic and feel real overwhelmed. And if you just separate them and you deal with each of them on their own, you feel a lot more confident in your ability to navigate a crisis. So there are two different storylines taking place. To a degree, they're connected. And if you're greedy and there's avaricious behavior and there's selfish behavior, it's hard to be idealistic. But even if they're separate, Moshe shows the resonance and the understanding of human nature. Say, by the way, it's not just about Israel. Let me take time out with the Israel issue. We'll talk about Israel in a moment. These priorities aren't correct. Okay? Fine. Let's skip a little bit to the end because it's a fascinating Rashi. We'll see if we have more time to get back to the middle. In the end, they're successful. They take over the land, and they rename some of the areas. So what are the areas that they rename? B'nai Ruvain built Cheshbon. They used to belong to Moab and then to Sichon. El-Ale, Kiryasoyim. So some familiar names, some other names. But Ves Nevo, Ves Baal Ma'on, Musa Bos Shem. So these names we haven't seen. Nevo and Baal Ma'on, although it's fascinating to think about. Is this the Har Nevo, Nevo? We don't know. And if it is, where did the name Nevo come from? So the Torah says, Musa Bos Shem. Musa Ba comes from the word Haseba, to turn around, Vayaseb Elokim, to invert. There was one route that was planned, and Hashem inverted the plan. They're no longer traveling up the western coast, they're traveling through the Midbar, going to the original plan. Haseba means where your body becomes inverted. Of course, we, Sobu, right, when Shir Shirim, when the woman tells the men, Sobu, go back, travel somewhere else, don't take the natural route that you'd want for this union. So what does it mean these names were inverted? So Rashi says, what does it mean they were inverted? Nevo Ubal Meon Shmos Avodas Elilim Hayimim. These were the names of shrines, pagan idol centers or pagan idol churches. Vehim Hamareim Karere Moshem Avodazar. Not just the shrines themselves, but the cities were called based on the religious connotations, based on the god, based on the shrine. Uvene Reuven Hasebu Eshmam Lishmos Acherim. Musabo Shem means the Bnei Reuven change the names. They were named something else, who knows, some ancient pagan name. B'nai Reuven, when they conquer them, they changed the name to Nevo and Baal Ma'on. So they were called Musa Bos Shem, the places whose names had been shifted, right? Remember, the communists changed all the original names into Leningrad and Stalingrad. Then, of course, when the communism fell, they would change back to their original names. Not original names, but at least previous names. Now, why is this important? Why is the Torah providing this information? So I think there are two issues. Number one is, we have a challenge, and our challenge is to stand for HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this world. And that's why when you get into Eretz Yisrael, and we'll read about this in Sefer Devarim, Abei Ta'abdonis Kala Makamos HaShav D'Shem HaGoyim, there's a specific mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael to eliminate Avodah Zarah, because Eretz Yisrael is the broadcasting station by which we want to demonstrate to the world monotheism. We want people to see, and Baruch Hashem, Yerushalayim has become the city of monotheism, where the world is much closer to monotheism than it ever was, and Yerushalayim has been responsible for that. You would think, though, that this is a local geographic mitzvah, that in Eretz Yisrael, we have a responsibility to stand for Hashem and to cleanse it and purge it of paganism so that we can create a monotheistic society and we can serve as a template for the world around us. In Chutz Laaretz, that's not necessarily our task. It's geographically dependent. In fact, there's actually a machlokas, Rambam and Ramban, whether the mitzvah of Abei Ta'abdin is called Mekamos, the destroying of Avodah Zarah. Again, we don't act upon the mitzvah today. But in theory, under a perfect world, when Hashem's presence is clear to everyone, do we have a mitzvah, Minatara, to eradicate Avodah Zarah in Chutz Laaretz? Maybe Avodah Zarah, not that it's a good thing, but people are searching for religion. Rav Lichtenstein would always speak about very, very nostalgically about the days in which people sought God and sought higher beings and sought higher authorities as opposed to the secular world of atheism and skepticism, which people are too content within the human edifices, less searching for a higher transcendent order. So maybe in Chutz Laaretz, certain types of paganism maybe they're not desirable, but we shouldn't necessarily be active in trying to switch them and trying to reroute them. Here you see Chutz La'aretz. This is really not Eretz Yisrael proper. There's no traditions of Eretz Yisrael. And yet the Jewish people are beginning that project, the project which hopefully will reach its climax in Eretz Yisrael, of trying to move the world further away from Avodah Zarah. And moving the world further away from Avodah Zarah, which you also see, it's not just theological. You have conferences and you have disputations and you get up on stage and you talk about religion. Sometimes culture is set by simple things such as names, simple things such as cultural associations. So you think, what difference does it make what the name is? Just write a book about paganism. Write a book debunking paganism. But something as trivial as what the name will be is going to seep into people's consciousness. So sometimes people come and ask me, Lahavdil, in the other way, how can I feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence more frequently in my life, more powerfully in my life? Think, well, read this Telsos and staff for this Tikkun Chatzos and go to this mikvah. So it's very simple. Just try to use the name Hashem more frequently in your life. Say Baruch Hashem more frequently. Say Emirat Hashem more frequently. Make a bracha with a little more kavana. And you'll feel Hashem's presence in a more palpable way. Sometimes we overshoot intellectual. People are very intellectually sophisticated. They overshoot the mark because they overthink. And they don't sufficiently appreciate the daily grounding and the salutary influence of day-to-day routine. So here, they're starting this agenda, and they're beginning this agenda even outside of Eretz Yisrael, and that's why the Torah records it. The second part is, I don't know how much time I have to talk about this today, is there really are two dramas taking place, aside from the two dramas I spoke about before, the ideology versus the moral drama. There's really a third drama, not just their commitment to Eretz Yisrael and their moral priorities. There's a third drama. Is this a rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And that's what Moshe really feels, fears. It's not just lack of courage, lack of loyalty, lack of unity, lack of commitment. This is Moshe fearing. This is just a front for a rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because so many of the problems, at least in the first generation, the problems really weren't the problems per se there. Like, for example, we spoke about this last week. What was Korach? Was it really an attack on Moshe's authority? Or was it really an attack against HaKadosh Baruch Hu? They were venting on Moshe. So Rashi conflates the two. Batzasam al Hashem, batzasam al Moshe. Rashi conflates the two. Very often in life, something appears as one thing, but it's really masking something else. Psychologically, community-wise, you have to get to the bottom. So Moshe fears, maybe this isn't just a question of courage and moral priorities. Maybe this is, once again, people that are rebelling against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's a whole different barrel of monkeys. It's a whole different way to deal with it. When you see them involved in theological correction and trying to rename places and move people away from Avodah Zarah and move people close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then he realizes, you know, this is real. They're not rebelling against Hashem. There are these issues. Sometimes, I spoke before, you simplify the issue. Sometimes you escalate the issue. You turn something into something that it isn't. Right, in relationships, very often, tensions happen when an issue escalates. You start with a little argument with someone about such and such, or with your wife about so-and-so, and then all of a sudden it escalates. We weren't talking about that. There's an old expression that was heard from someone, stay in Cleveland. Stay in Cleveland. Keep the argument in Cleveland. Don't go to Chicago. Once the argument goes to Chicago, it becomes swelled, it becomes larger. Just talk about, and very often, people turn arguments into something much, much larger, so Moshe has basically escalated the situation. In his mind, at least he fears that. And then when he sees them acting theologically, he says, you know what, this is all right. Another thing that he sees, which is interesting, with this I'll end, because it's such an iconic pasuk, is the, remember, he's approached by a lot of factions. There's a lot of factions here. Once again, whenever you see factions, you start to worry whether people are bandwagging, whether, well, this is really the Korach effect, right? This is what's called in today's world intersectionality, where people bandwagon on each other's agendas. So bandwagons is never healthy because there's no sincerity, there's no authenticity. We know that people all are feeling the same issue and there's sincerity. They could be right, they could be wrong, but you never want to dismiss sincerity. You do want to be careful about bandwagon. So what's happening here? Pasuk Chavei, Vayomer b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven el Moshe lemor, Avodecha yasu k'shad adi mitzvah. So what does Rashi say? Reminiscent of Har Sinai, Vayichan sham yisol neged har, where collective is described in the singular term, Vayomer b'nei Gad. Fascinating Rashi. Kulam ki ish echad. It's almost the same Rashi from Parshas Yisra. Now, what is Moshe saying? I mean, that could be very dangerous also. That could be toxic, where everyone is collaborating and conspiring. You've got different factions here. You've got different tribes. And remember, they've lived essentially apart for 38 years because there's very little unifying them, right? war unifies. Common enemies unify. Har Sinai unifies. They live nothing lives. They live basically in their own encampments, in their own areas. So you'd think that each would have their own designs, and those designs would be very different. And the only unifying factor would be their divorcing from the Jewish people, secessionary tendencies, and rebellion against Moshe Rabbeinu. When they speak with unity and presumably harmony, that's something that Moshe respects. And he didn't see it in Korach. We spoke before about why this isn't the Meraglim. In his mind, he's also probably thinking a little bit about Korach. And he sees in Korach there's no unity. Everyone has their own agenda. You've got the Dasan and Avirim and the 250 and the Korach and the Mishpachto. That's why we have multiple different punishments because they're just different people. And the punishments reinforce how sparse and how dispersed this entire process was. Here, Moshe senses their unity. And to him, this is the slow process of convincing Moshe that there is sincerity and authenticity that has to be acknowledged, rather than, this is tzlefcha, not korach. This is something you should respond to favorably, rather than defend against and war against. It's the theological, it's the name-changing, it's the B'nai God, and quote some other Rashis, they overcommit. Sometimes when you're suspected of someone, in order to avoid suspicion, you have to do more than is necessary. It's always good to do more than is necessary to show your true colors. So Moshe says, until you capture, they say, according to Rashi, you know what, we'll take the 14 years. No, 7 extra years away from your family. It's not pleasant, right? Another 7 years. So there's a process here. And it's a story of human nature, of suspicion and convincing people not to suspect you, how to build trust, how to just deconstruct situations, how to see multiple layers in a situation, how to associate between moral concerns and ideological concerns. There's a real human drama unfolding in the end. If you trace Rashi, you'll see a lot of this coming forward. Okay? Have a good day, everyone.